This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Recently, the first ever International Flat Earth Conference was held. What is the Flat Earth? One participant from the conference explains.
The Flat Earth would be a circular flat area surrounded by a field that is known as Antarctica.
Media outlet Vice News made a short film about these people who believe that the Earth is flat. This is contrary to what we all know to be scientifically true, that the Earth is actually a sphere. They sincerely believe that governments and scientists have been lying to us all along.
They're lying. I ain't buying.
So who's they?
Well, basically, Satan.
I don't necessarily want to get into like naming. It's like, you know, is it the Illuminati or the Bilderbergs?
The Jesuits, the Freemasons.
Or the Trilateral Commission, or the Vatican.
The Zionist, NASA, of course.
But why do people believe this crazy idea, despite the fact that we have so much scientific evidence showing that the Earth is round? This is Why It's So Like That, a show that explores the mind, our behavior, and why we are the way we are. On our show today, we'll be exploring the psychology of conspiracy theorists. Flat Earth isn't the only conspiracy theory out there. There are other examples, like apparently how the world's elites are actually humanoid lizards, and that we didn't actually land on the moon. Why do people believe these ideas? Of course, we can easily paint these people as just plain loony, but there are actually some very good reasons for their beliefs. Someone who studies this behavior is Chris French. Chris is professor of psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London. He leads the anomalistic psychology research unit there. Chris, in your work, what defines a conspiracy theory?
Well, typically when we talk about conspiracy theories, and particularly the psychology of conspiracy theories, it's important to say we're not denying that conspiracies sometimes take place. I mean, there's lots of historical examples, Watergate, for example, where conspiracies really do take place. The kind of conspiracies that we're particularly interested in are those where it's alleged that there's a sinister plot by a few hidden, very, very powerful individuals who are pulling the strings behind typically major world events with malign intent. So, I mean, there's lots of examples of that. I mean, not all conspiracies would fit into that kind of a description, but typically we're saying that there's something happening behind the scenes, there's some kind of hidden plot, and that the official story that we're being fed is just a cover for what's really going on.
Is there a certain profile that we can attach to a person who believes in conspiracy theories?
There is. Again, here we're talking about kind of group differences. So you'll typically find that people who believe in conspiracy theories tend to be very distrustful, not only of big institutions, governments, news agencies, et cetera, but even interpersonally. They'll be less trustful of their own neighbours, the people they work with, and so on and so forth. They often see themselves as being outsiders, people on the edges of society. And often, to some extent, people who feel that life hasn't been good to them, that they've got kind of various chips on their shoulder, if you like, and they're looking for explanations as to why things are the way they are. They feel that things are beyond their control, and that their belief in conspiracies is part of an attempt to try to kind of regain some of that control, to figure out what's going on behind the scenes.
Chris, I've always wondered whether these people who believe in conspiracy theories actually do believe in them, or if they have more malicious intentions, like they're doing it just for the fun of misinformation, for example.
Well, again, for the hardcore conspiracy believers, they're typically totally sincere in what they believe, and they see what they're doing as actually, and if you like, an attempt to kind of raise the alarm, to warn the world about what's really going on as they see it. I think beyond that hardcore, there are quite a lot of people who, as your question implies, might say that they believe in a conspiracy partly out of a kind of, it's just something they've heard about, and it kind of sounds exciting and interesting. So, I mean, take, for example, the idea that we didn't really land on the moon. It was all faked in Hollywood studios. Now, again, I think a lot of people have kind of bought into that idea because it's quite a kind of an entertaining, interesting, exciting idea. Whereas people who believe that governments are actually kind of trying to poison us or control our minds or all of these other things, that's kind of much more sinister. So the hardcore, definitely, totally sincere, it's a core part of their identity. Whereas for a lot of other people who maybe have just heard something in the pub or have seen something on TV, they probably don't. It's not that important to them whether the conspiracy is true or not. It's not a part of their self-identity. So there's a whole kind of continuum there.
Are they just attention-seeking then for those who believe in conspiracy theories quite seriously?
No, I don't think they are. I think they genuinely believe that there's a kind of that these threats are there from these sinister individuals, and I tend not to believe in most of these theories that they're putting forward. But I do actually kind of respect the fact that they genuinely do believe it, and they're trying to warn the rest of the population. I mean, basically, in their eyes, there's only two. If you don't buy into their belief system, if you don't believe that these conspiracies are really happening, there's only two possibilities. Either you are part of the conspiracy yourself, and I'm often accused of that, or alternatively, You're just stupid. You've been fooled. You've been taken in by the conspirators. There's only those two categories. If you don't believe it, you're in one of those two categories.
Have you personally dealt with conspiracy theorists before?
Well, let me tell you a story that actually, if anything, shows the opposite. It shows how difficult it is to convince conspiracy theorists. I was involved in organising a one-day event on conspiracy theories. And we had David Aronovich lined up as being our headline speaker, so we were all very pleased about that. But sadly, he had to pull out. He wasn't well. And we'd also got word of the fact that this one-day conference we had planned was being discussed on various conspiracy theory forums. But basically, what was being said was things like, is this just a meeting of like-minded academics, or is it something far more sinister? And I'm thinking, well, I know it's not anything far more sinister because it was my idea. I came up with it in the pub, It was just talking to a friend. Anyway, we decided we'd try and solve this problem by killing two birds with one stone. We'd fill this slot that we now had because one of our speakers wasn't going to be there by inviting the conspiracy theorists to send along a speaker to present their view of the way the world is, which we did. So it made for a very interesting event. In the pub afterwards, we're all sitting talking. And one of my students at the time, Rob Brotherton, who's written a very, very good book on conspiracy theories, by the way, called Suspicious Minds. I would highly recommend it. He's talking to one of the conspiracy believers and raises the fairly obvious point. He says to this guy, look, if you're right that there's massive conspiracies going on, and that anybody who tries to blow the whistle on them and make others aware of it, they're putting their own lives at risk by doing that, how come we've just heard your man there talking for an hour to a packed audience of several hundred people? Isn't he putting his life at risk doing that? And this other guy kind of leaned forward and whispers in Rob's ear, well, actually, we think he's probably a plant. So what can you do? They've got an answer for everything.
I notice with conspiracy theories that a lot of them seem to be against elitist or other very big organizations. Like, they thought you were part of a big group that's plotting something very evil, for example. This is just because you're part of the education system. Why is there this link between conspiracy theories and a distrust of authorities?
I think that link is there because the alternative to the conspiracy theories is what they would refer to as the official story. And that's coming from the establishment. Now, the establishment, that obviously would include governments, intelligence agencies, all kinds of other kind of higher order institutions. But it must also include the BBC. It must include your own channel of information. The news that your channel's putting out must be part of the conspiracy. It's all this misinformation and disinformation that's being put out as part of the conspiracy. And where do news agencies get their information from? Well, typically they'll turn to experts in universities. So the people in universities must be in on the conspiracy as well. And it expands and expands and takes in more and more people. But all of these people, and this is one of the reasons obviously why a lot of these conspiracies are completely implausible, because they'd have to involve so many people, none of whom seem to be willing to blow the whistle on the conspiracy. But all of those people would be seen as being part of the establishment and therefore not to be trusted. Any kind of evidence that I might produce that suggested that a particular conspiracy wasn't true can be dismissed because I'm part of the conspiracy. So it's a non-falsifiable hypothesis.
After this, Chris and I talk about the internet and social media and how it's changed the way conspiracy theories spread. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. The subject of today is the psychology of conspiracy theorists, and my guest is Chris French from Goldsmiths, University of London. Chris, I noticed that conspiracy theories tend to pop up very much after major traumatic events. After the recent Las Vegas shooting, for example, some people believe that the government had staged the whole thing, or that the victims of the shooting were actually actors participating in a hoax. Similar theories also popped up when the Boston Marathon bombings happened. Why is this so prevalent?
It's this thing of people feeling out of control. I mean, we've got a very deep innate tendency to believe that the world is a just place and that kind of awful things don't happen to good people just out of the blue. Truth is, they do. You know, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, all of these things can just appear suddenly out of the blue. And for a lot of people, that makes it feel like everything's out of control. They don't know how they can kind of plan their lives, how they can live their lives. The idea that actually there was someone or something behind these events that was kind of in control is, in some kind of ironic sense, it makes them feel better. And also the fact that they know that they're in on this secret. They've actually figured it out. And we can see this in other examples of magical thinking. I mean, I would put belief in conspiracies in the same general category of magical thinking as, say, paranormal beliefs. And again, in a lot of these situations where we've done experiments that manipulate people's sense of control, you'll see that that tends to increase their belief in conspiracies, their belief in the paranormal, belief in superstitions, and so on and so forth. And it's all this, it's this attempt to try to regain some kind of sense of control that's at the root of it. And so when we have these horrific terrorist attacks, then this is a kind of prime example. I mean, one of the interesting things about these attacks, of course, is that you can guarantee that the next time there is a similar attack, even before the authorities have had any chance to actually examine the situation, find out what happened, there'll be conspiracy theorists on the internet within seconds saying this was a false flag operation. You know, this wasn't really a terrorist attack. It was the government trying to manipulate us. And clearly, they're not basing that on an objective assessment of the evidence because nobody's had the time to assess the evidence at that point. But within seconds, those conspiracy theories will be spread around the world thanks to the internet.
It's interesting what the internet is doing to conspiracy theories. I always assumed that because the internet can provide us with so much reliable and verifiable information that it would have been the greatest mythbuster ever. But that's not the case at all. Conspiracy theories actually thrive on the internet because people publish all these theories without confirming them first.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely correct. I mean, I sometimes kind of refer to conspiracy theorists as being kind of, they're skeptics, but without the critical thinking skills. So, I mean, it's a good thing that we don't just accept what we're told by the authorities. We should question it. We should examine it. But it doesn't follow from that everything that comes from an official source is therefore a lie. That just doesn't follow at all. Sometimes we do know that governments will put a particular spin on a particular story or some kind of announcement. And it's good that people will look at that and they'll critically assess it. But you do need to be able to critically assess it. And you also need to be aware of the fact that not everything that comes from official news sources is a lie. I would like to believe that you know, we do have some news sources that are actually quite reliable, relatively speaking. And I wouldn't include in that kind of the likes of David Icke and Alex Jones, who come out with these crazy, crazy theories, and yet a lot of people listen to them.
Right, with David Icke's claim that the world's elite are actually lizard people, whereas Alex Jones's claim that the Boston Marathon bombings was actually done by the government. If I may, I'd like to move our conversation now to talking about the structure of conspiracy theories, because so far we've only spoken about the people who believe them. What makes a conspiracy theory so believable and appealing?
I think, well, it's a number of things, but one of the most important is that they are, by their very nature, non-falsifiable. First of all, they're appealing to a number of kind of fairly kind of central instincts that maybe we all have to some extent. This need for kind of understanding the bigger picture, trying to gain some kind of sense of control to be able to predict what might happen in the future. So try and make sense of the way the world is. That's a kind of huge part of it. But they're what are sometimes referred to as intellectual black holes. Once you've bought into the conspiracy theory, then there's no kind of evidence that could convince you that you're wrong. They're non-falsifiable. So any evidence that seems to go against the conspiracy theory can be dismissed as being misinformation or disinformation. It doesn't need to be taken seriously. Any kind of bit of ambiguous evidence which maybe can be taken as supporting the theory is latched onto. And another thing about conspiracy theories, you've probably found this yourself if you've ever tried to argue with a 9/11 truther, is trying to convince them that they might be wrong is like trying to nail jelly to the wall, because you might kind of, they'll come up with, how do you explain X? And you'll give them an explanation of X, and they'll say, well, okay then, but what about Y? And you'll explain why. And they'll say, okay, then, but what about, and there's because you're in these, particularly in those kind of conspiracy situations, there are so many different angles that people can take in trying to argue that you just can't argue with them. They will never be convinced that they might potentially be wrong. I mean, there is evidence that could convince me that in principle, that some of these conspiracies actually were true, but the conspiracy theorists themselves typically could never be convinced they're wrong.
Chris, could you talk about some of the experiments you've done investigating the psychology of conspiracy theories? I remember one interesting one where when you tested people on who believed in conspiracy theory, they tended to believe in two separate contradictory theories.
That's actually not one of our publications, but it's a very, very interesting study by a friend of mine, Karen Douglas, and her team. What you find is that the single best predictor of whether you believe in conspiracy X is, do you believe in conspiracy Y, even if they're totally, totally different conspiracies. So, for example, you're more likely to believe that we didn't really land on the moon if you also believe that Diana was killed by the British Secret Service, for example. Now, there's no logical connection between those two theories, but if you believe in one, you're more likely to believe in the other as well. And that goes so far even as mutually contradictory theories. So in a very nice study by Karen Douglas and colleagues, they found that if you tend to believe that Osama bin Laden isn't really dead, you're also more likely to endorse a statement that says that he was actually killed by the Americans years before they officially announced it. Now, clearly, both of those can't be true. He can't be dead and alive at the same time. I mean, what explains this apparent contradiction is it's a general distrust of the official story. So they don't trust what they are being told. Something is being covered up. And again, this is another element with conspiracy believers, that very often they're not putting forward a very specific alternative explanation to the official explanation. They are just saying, I don't believe the official explanation, something's being covered up, which makes it, again, very difficult to argue with them, because if you prove that one version of their conspiracy theory is wrong, then they'll just change it into something else. And so you find that the line is constantly shifting. I mean, to give you an example of one of our own studies, this is with Rob Brotherton. We looked at what's called the intentionality bias. another of the kind of cognitive biases which seems to be linked to a tendency to believe in conspiracies is this thing called the intentionality bias, which again, we all have. Children show it very strongly. Typically, as we grow up, we learn to inhibit it. But our kind of default, if you like, even though we're not consciously aware of it, when something happens in around us in the world, we tend to assume that someone or something made it happen. Now, sometimes, of course, that is true. Sometimes it isn't true. Sometimes that noise you hear in the night is just the wind blowing the branches against your window or whatever else it may be. But we seem to have evolved to have this kind of default assumption, which is basically to kind of assume that someone or something made that happen. In evolutionary terms, it makes sense. It might be a potential threat. But as we kind of grow up, we kind of learn to inhibit that. Our first kind of unconscious almost assumption is that someone or something made it happen, but then we override it and we realize that sometimes things happen without someone having an intention behind it. Now, this fits in with a kind of conspiracy worldview, because in the conspiracy theorist's mind, nothing happens by accident. So the idea that Diana's car might have crashed in that tunnel in Paris just because it was a slightly tipsy driver, that's not possible. It was all planned. Now, when you stop and think about it, if you did want to actually assassinate someone, one of the most unreliable methods you could come up with would be to get their driver slightly drunk. You know, there's no guarantee that that person's going to crash the car. There's no guarantee that if a crash does take place, everybody will be killed. Tragically, that is what seems to have happened in this case. But most people would be happy to accept that it was an accident caused by him racing away from the paparazzi rather than some planned assassination attempt by sinister forces. But what we found in our experiment, long story short, was by using various experimental techniques, yes, indeed, people who believe in conspiracies tend to show this intentionality bias more than people who don't. Another example of a cognitive bias that seems to be there is that we tend to assume that big events must have big causes. So the idea that a deranged lone gunman was enough to assassinate JFK with all the repercussions that that had, again, doesn't really sit well with us. We assume there must be a big cause behind that big event. Therefore, there must have been some kind of big conspiracy behind it. And again, there's experimental evidence to back up that.
We have the news coming up, but after this, Chris gives us some tips on how to deal with conspiracy theorists. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to The Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. This is Why You're So Like That, a show that's about the mind, our behavior, and why we are the way we are. We're talking about conspiracy theories today. There are plenty of pretty wild theories out there, like how the US government faked the moon landing, and that the world's elite are actually humanoid lizards. Why do people believe in these theories? Chris French has some answers for us. He's a professor of psychology from Goldsmiths, University of London. Chris, I listed some conspiracy theories, but what are some of your favourites?
I think it depends there what you mean by favourite conspiracy theory, insofar as I think some conspiracy theories are kind of more believable than others. I mean, again, as I said earlier, we're not saying that conspiracies never really happen. And sometimes it's possible to be too skeptical in approaching conspiracy theories. I mean, before the Edward Snowden revelations, for example, I think if someone had told me about what was being claimed there, I may well have rejected it, thinking it was, you know, too conspiracy minded for me. Turns out it was true. You know, the kind of surveillance of ordinary people is kind of much more extensive than I perhaps would have believed. Some of the conspiracy theories around are kind of intrinsically, I think, more believable. The idea that there are powerful vested interests who will sometimes try to manipulate events to their own advantage and self-interest. Yeah, I can buy that. That's not too hard to believe. There are other conspiracy theories that I like in the sense that they are so really intricate and complicated and interesting because there are so many different angles on them. I suppose the 9/11 as an inside job conspiracy would be one example. The faked moon landings would be another. I like those because they're so creative. The kind of number of different angles that people have brought into them, even though I obviously don't believe in them for 1 second. And then there are those that I love just because they're so completely wacky. And I suppose probably top of the list there would have to be David Icke's claims that the world is being run by shape-shifting lizards. I mean, you know, you've got to kind of tip your hat there to such a completely crazy, wacky idea. And yet a lot of people are prepared to listen to David Icke and take what he says seriously.
I wonder, you know, like the Edward Snowden case where a few years ago people were saying, oh, the government's listening to your phones and they're reading all our messages. And people thought that that was a conspiracy theory, but it turned out to be true. I wonder how cases like this affect how people think about conspiracy theories. They could be like, oh, this was true after all, so why can't this be true, for example?
Yeah, I think that is quite likely to happen. You know, I mean, it's it makes life very difficult. I mean, I think one of the reasons that conspiracy theories appeal to some people is that even though the conspiracy theories themselves may often be very complicated, the kind of overarching idea that there are these conspiracies going on and there are good guys and bad guys and so on, it's a fairly nice, simple view of the world. I mean, the world in reality is much messier than that. There are rarely people who are completely 100% good guys or 100% bad guys. There's lots and lots of nuance. And in reality is messy. You know, whenever there's a major world event, there's going to be all kinds of initial news reports that contain kind of information that's wrong because, you know, they hadn't had a chance to check it and so on and so forth. We like to see the world in terms of kind of, you know, simple black and white. We'd like to think of ourselves as being the good guys and those other guys over there as the bad guys. We all do that. But at the end of the day, as I say, we need to try to educate people to be able to engage in critical thinking, to look at the evidence. We don't want to kind of shut people down, stop them from discussing these things or putting forward these ideas. But if we could get people to get better at being able to kind of recognize fake news and distinguish it from kind of more reliable sources, I think that would be a big step forward. But as you say, when it turns out that something that was initially would have been dismissed as being just another conspiracy theory actually turns out to be true, that is going to shake people's confidence in the powers that be and in authorities. And it's a good thing that we keep our eye on them. We do need to not just accept everything we're told.
Right, I want to talk about one very prominent conspiracy theory, which is that vaccines cause autism.
Uh-huh.
You know, despite hundreds and hundreds of studies done that disproves that fact, and despite the fact that we're all walking without measles or mumps or rubella, why is it so difficult for people who believe in this conspiracy theory to believe that, hey, they might actually be wrong, that vaccines don't actually cause autism?
And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the important reason is that at the time when Andrew Wakefield was first making these kinds of claims, particularly with respect to the MMR vaccine and the idea that it might cause autism, that the press gave an unwarranted amount of coverage to Wakefield's views. I mean, it's easy to forget that now, because whenever Wakefield's referred to in the mainstream press now, it's always as, you know, somebody who's been totally discredited. But it was the press, it was the media themselves that actually helped him to gain that prominence in the first place. And what you typically found then was the way these stories were covered would be, on the one hand, you had all of the kind of very dry epidemiological evidence, statistical evidence showing there was no link between the vaccine and autism. But in the interests of what the journalist would see as balance, they would have that along with a story from a crying mother who said that, you know, her baby was perfectly normal until the baby had the vaccine and then the behavior changed. And in other words, you know, this is evidence that the vaccine causes autism, which of course isn't at all in properly scientific terms. But when people were reading stories like that, the emotional impact of seeing a mother who is clearly very, very distressed and very unhappy, and, you know, I mean, our heart goes out to people in that situation, that has much more impact on people than what they see as being kind of dry statistics. So I think that was an important factor. People like Andrew Wakefield see themselves and their followers see it in the same way as kind of being persecuted in the way that Galileo was not believed when he made his announcements. They see themselves as being pioneers. And that is a kind of a very appealing image for lots of people, particularly people who distrust conventional medicine, who think it's all controlled by Big Pharma. And again, I mean, one of the problems there is that Big Pharma, you know, is a very good example of a kind of institution, if you like, which does behave in ways at times that seem to be more interested in profit than the kind of more general well-being of the community. So people do have some good reasons to distrust Big Pharma, but that doesn't mean that there's this massive conspiracy and that these, you know, that it's all about trying to make profit at the expense of individuals. I mean, and that fits into a wider conspiracy worldview picture that, conventional medicine is all about keeping people sick, not helping them to get better, keeping them sick so that you can make more money out of them. And again, that just isn't the case. But if people buy into that kind of worldview, and maybe they've turned to complementary and alternative therapies and so on, it seems to them to be a very, very consistent kind of picture. It makes sense for them, despite the fact that the scientific evidence shows quite conclusively there are no links between vaccines and autism, for example. And so, I mean, I think there's lots of other factors as well, but one other that I would mention is that from a psychological point of view, if you are a worried parent and you've heard these claims and you don't know whether they're true or not, it feels better psychologically to not do anything rather than take an action which might, in your mind, have a damaging effect, such as causing autism. To not do anything, people feel that, well, I've not caused it. But of course you have, if your child then goes on to develop measles or some other serious disease as a result of not being vaccinated. So, but just this whole kind of bias towards being risk averse in the sense of not wanting to take an action that might have risks attached to it, even though in fact the reality is by not taking the action, you're increasing the risks to the child. But again, in our minds, those two things are kind of very different. So there's a lot of factors involved there. But, you know, we do need to get the message out that not only for your own children's sake, but for the wider community's sake, people should get their children vaccinated.
It's interesting that you also brought up how conspiracy theories make the world look simpler than it actually is. Is that why people believe that global warming is a conspiracy theory? Because it's just, you know, we are actually very much responsible for the state of the planet right now. And by believing that global warming is a conspiracy theory, we kind of shake our hands off this problem.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, and that's a kind of good example, I suppose, because it involves what you call kind of motivated reasoning. I mean, we all find it easier to believe things that we want to be true. I mean, and in this case, the idea that global warming isn't really happening, or if it is happening, it's not down to human activity, human behavior. We don't want to feel responsible for destroying the planet for future generations. So how can we resolve this? It kind of sets a kind of cognitive dissonance up in our minds that on the one hand, you know, we're being told that we are causing these problems by the way that we behave, not being kind of green enough in our behavior. And on the other hand, obviously, as I say, you know, maybe especially if you've got kind of kids and grandkids, you don't want to think that you're leaving them with all these problems in the future. So one way to resolve it is to say, well, it's not really happening at all, or if it is happening, it's nothing to do with human behavior. Therefore, I don't have to change my ways. And again, this is a nice example of sometimes people kind of say, well, you know, conspiracy theories might all be a load of old rubbish and not true, but hey, they don't do any real harm. Well, yes, they do, because people who believe that climate change either isn't really happening or isn't being caused by humans are less likely to engage in recycling, etc., etc. They're less likely to support initiatives that will be paid for from taxes to try to protect the planet and so on and so forth. And again, another example would be belief that vaccinations can cause damaging kind of effects like autism. Those people are less likely to get their kids vaccinated, and that reduces herd immunity. It's been estimated that the kind of conspiracy theories that AIDS was kind of deliberately manufactured for various sinister ends, and that the treatments available didn't really work, cost literally hundreds of thousands of lives because people weren't getting the treatment that could have saved their lives. So it's not always the case that these belief in conspiracy theories are just harmless. Okay, it doesn't really matter one way or the other whether you personally believe that we landed on the moon or not. That's not going to kind of have any implications for anybody else. But these other things actually do. So, you know, we do need to take belief in conspiracy theories seriously, and we do need to try and do what we can to counter belief in unfounded conspiracy theories.
So what can we do then? How can we engage people who believe in conspiracy theories?
I think all we can try and do, I think, is to try to kind of open people's eyes to the fact that there is a lot of misinformation out there. There are ways of trying to kind of ask various questions, even kind of, you know, Google and other kind of bodies like that are waking up to the fact that they need to take these issues more seriously and to try and advise people regarding how you can try and decide whether a story is true or not. And not immediately buying into ideas just because they fit with your worldview. It's so easy to do that. You know, you say, and I've put my hand up to this. I'm guilty occasionally of retweeting something that fits with my views of the way the world is and then finding out it was fake news. And I feel terrible when I've done that because I've helped to spread this, you know, this awful fake news around the world. But there are ways of kind of trying to do it. Ask yourself the question, I mean, you know, if this was real news, would we have already heard about it through other channels? Who's going to be, is there some kind of agenda behind this? Who's going to kind of profit from this idea spreading? And where's the information come from? Has it come from a kind of reputable body? And of course, again, that raises issues because the sources that I would trust, medical research carried out in proper universities, et cetera, maybe not the sources that the conspiracy theorists would trust. I mean, so many of the people who follow Trump, for example, believe Trump, even though he clearly contradicts himself left, right, and center, they would see him as being the final authority on what's true. And if he dismisses a news report that everybody else accepts as true as being fake news, well, that's good enough for them. So it's an uphill battle, but we have to carry on.
That was Chris French, Professor of Psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London. He leads a normalistic psychology research unit there. If you've missed any part of this show, you can download the podcast from our BFM app. It's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.